Hello, I am a nerd from the Nerd Brigade, here to nerd out on all your audio and visual needs.
Do you have to say that every time you show up at a house?
If I want to get paid, yes.
Isn't that kind of demeaning?
Only if someone brings it up.
Oh, okay. I won't bring it up then.
Thanks. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my host companion, Sejan Serowick. Sejan, how are you this lovely evening?
Quite good, in fact, Devin. Quite good. Yet another enjoyable experience revisiting the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, and now I get to be here talking about it with you, parsing apart some of the most dark and really just dank crevices of cinematic history in which we watched this film, and I am once again reminded that at some point someone had sex with a Q-Bert.
Yes, truly, we've explored four other films so far in our journey into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, and I would be lying if I didn't admit straight up that Pixels was the movie I was the most excited to watch for this show.
Somebody fucks Q-Bert. Okay.
And Adam Sandler kind of has a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's brought up. I won't say that it's ignored in a film. It is addressed within the script.
The worst part about somebody fucking Q-Bert is that on the two, it took two viewings for me to make sure that this wasn't just in my head or like sleep deprivation from my late night viewing last night. When Q-Bert is first introduced, the read I got from Josh Gad is that he kind of wanted to fuck Q-Bert.
He's already into Q-Bert. By the time he sees Q-Bert, he's already into Q-Bert. I wrote down. Okay.
I think I found our next trophy, guys.
Okay, we're... Oh my god. Okay. There is an order to this show, and I do not want to disrupt that order, so I'm going to respect that and not talk about this any longer until we get through some of like our initial steps to this. But we got to talk about Josh Gad and Q-Bert at some point.
Oh, don't.
Also, I'm going to read one note early because I do not want to talk about it, so I'm just going to read it now where it'll die when we go into the actual minutia of the episode. The one note that I have written down is, I wonder if Q-Bert has a cloaca.
Wow!
Okay, all right. So, normally, when we start this show, we do initial, like, reads, right? Like, going into it, right?
Yes. Well, the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe is us. Again, Devin Decker and Sejan Serowick. We're from the Say Report. And this is our more focused excursion into the... into pop culture, and we're focusing on creating our definitive roadmap to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. That's why we're here, hopefully to, you know, get that guidance from our Rand McNally-esque book that we're putting together in spoken word. That's why you're here. So that's what we are. We're here to do that. And first impressions, Sejan, I love this movie. This is a movie that I have seen, I want to say 100 times, but honestly, since it's been out since 2015, and I saw it twice that year that it came out, and then I've seen it at least one time each subsequent year, I think it would be safe to say I've seen it 8 times.
In full,
tip to tail.
I
gotta
be honest. The
invested.
Fact that it's less than a solid 10. I'm actually surprised. I will say, but that's. I mean, it makes sense. We're not on the 10-year anniversary yet. I will give you that. Like we are slowly approaching the modern Sandler. But yeah. So 8 times is still a lot. That's more than once a year by its being out in 2015. Everybody.
Yeah, 2015. I think that's gonna come in and be important. And after watching all of the other movies that we've watched so far, this is our 5th episode in our first excursion into the universe. And so far we've looked at Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy, and Little Nicky, and now we're right at Pixels. And with all of that weighing on my mind as I went into Pixels for my seventh and eighth viewings, Pixels somehow became a deeper movie for me.
I am happy to hear you say that, Dev, because my first thought on the entire movie was, well, I fucking hope Devin has something to talk about. So first impressions, right? Right. So yeah. Like my history with it and how I'm feeling at this very moment. So I think this might be the first time that I watched from like tail to tip, beginning to credits, Pixels.
Congratulations.
I definitely have seen pieces of it before. It's one of those movies that like being who I am and in my life could not be ignored when it came out. But apparently I tried my fucking damnedest because I never actually saw the entirety of it. But like I knew about like the Pac-Man stuff, you know, I knew about I'm killing myself that I don't have his name right on the tip of my tongue. But the creator of Pac-Man, like I remember that moment of him getting his hand chewed off. Right. Like there's moments of this movie that resonate in my head, but I definitely know that I didn't remember the entire opening of this of him as a kid. Not that I wasn't aware that it existed. I knew that that was part of the movie, but very clearly I was like, there's parts of that movie I've never seen, including like the entire setup. I've never seen the conclusion of this film. I had no idea how this movie ended. And there's definitely moments in between that I'm like, this was unexpected. And so at the end of this movie, I will say that I am coming into this episode with one, it's not even a question, but a challenge. That's what it is. Purely a challenge. I want to know why you, Devin, because this was your choice. I'm not going to hide that. Why you feel this is part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Oh, fuck you, CJ.
And I'm gonna pull a bigger bullshit move on you. It cannot just be a double V name, because even that is questionable in this movie.
Yeah, that's why I said fuck you. First of all, before we go any further, the creator of Pac-Man is Toru Iwatomi.
Thank
and
you.
He shows up in the Much film,
respect. Yeah,
but not playing himself.
He shows up in the beginning, like taking notes at the board, right?
He is repairing a Pac-Man machine at the arcade that Sam and Will go to at the very beginning of the movie.
And there's a lot of that sort of thing going on in this movie. A lot of things that I'm gonna kick my own ass here because I just gave you all this shit about how I've got some issues with including this in the preliminary founding building blocks of the cinematic universe. But I think where I was sold on this working, because I'm not gonna fucking make you like sit here and do court case style prove to me this movie's worth it. I do think it fits in. But I think what really made it matter for me was literally when the credits rolled and I realized how many people were just there working on this film. I have championed the idea that an Adam Sandler movie is not made for the idea of accolades or like movie like greatness, but made entirely by just people, friends, family that just this is what they do together. And I cannot tell you how many fucking people show up in this movie that I was like, okay, all right, that's a Sandler. That's a Sandler. That's a video game nut. That's Kevin James's friend. That's like there's so many people that show up and I didn't realize it until credits rolled how much that was actually true.
And that is actually, I mean, Alan Covert is in this film. And I didn't notice him until this viewing of it because he is in the background. And honestly, part of my argument would be I could kind of prove that he's is it Oscar? His character from Happy Gilmore. Oh. he's almost that disgruntled and he looks that way. And if he's not that, then I could make the argument that he's Walter from The Waterboy. Nice. It's very much that the disgruntled character that he is portraying in that moment could very easily be those two smaller disgruntled roles that he has played. Clearly not Todd from Little Nicky, but...
Right. Yeah. But he shows up just to yell at Kevin James, right?
Yeah, just to yell at Kevin James in the beginning.
Shout out to the... Like, we have to... I feel like we should, like, pop some fucking, like, confetti and celebrate the introduction of Kevin James to the Adam Sandler universe.
I know, that's a big part. I mean, he's been in other stuff, but this is okay. So I guess we do have a structure here, and I don't want to move away from it. But that challenge that you issued, I would like to just get my opening statement in. You said we're not going to do it court style, but it feels like the proper way to start is with my opening statement. And my argument initially was the double V, and I will admit that is questionable because her name is Violet Van Patten. So there's a third, you know, consonant sound there that sort of disrupts the double V pattern of all the other films that we've discussed and said, obviously, these are the foundational building blocks of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
But there are sensibilities and there are straight character moments that are picked from the original key films that we said were the building blocks of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And I think that is where I would further build my argument. And there's a time and a place to get there. But I do have to say, that challenge, you had me shaking in my boots. Because the double V thing is tenuous with Pixels.
Okay, and just to and to address the double V thing here and now, because as we mentioned, it is a three-name process, I will point out, as a scholar, I have to admit, I think both Chicago style and MLA style recognize that if there is a prefix before the surname, it actually gets included with the surname in any type of subsequent like printing. So like whenever you put somebody's last name first name last type situation, you include the Van with whatever the last name is. So her name would show up as Van Patten,
comma,
what's her name?
Violet.
Violet. Yeah. Right. So it holds. I won't take that away from you.
I almost took it away from myself.
I know you did. And that's why I wanted to make sure that I went so deep down the rabbit hole of trying to make sure that I could be with you on this that like I even found that. But the idea being that like that can't be the only reason that we include this movie today. And I don't think it will be. We're gonna keep talking. As you said, there will be a time and a place to talk about it. But I definitely questioned it the entire time I was watching this movie, and I do not doubt that avid followers, shall we say, of this show will definitely hold us to account if we don't address that fact.
Yeah, I mean, I'd hold myself to account, so I certainly hope the listener would. Before we continue any further, do you have some facts and figures for me on this film?
I got a few facts and figures on this film. So I think one of the things that was really interesting the most about this movie, so it is a 2015 movie, as I talked about. It came out the weekend of July 24th. So like not a 4th of July movie, which was kind of weird to me because there's a lot of things going on with this movie, not least of which, and we'll talk more about this, but the idea that this is Adam Sandler and crew, friends, family, working with Chris Columbus as a director. Chris, like 1492 produced this movie with him. Like this is kind of a big deal because this is not Adam Sandler and his friends just making a movie and somebody's just covering the bill. This is a company wanted to make this movie and approached Adam Sandler and his crew to be the ones to be involved. Like somebody thought, we need to make a Pixels movie. And that is because I'd be remiss if I did not mention that this came from a 2010 short film made by a French director. And that movie was very well received. I'm pulling up the director's name. That's why I'm like buying for time. Patrick Jean. I imagine it's Jean though because
it's
French.
Because he's French.
So it's a 2010 short film about New York getting attacked by all these giant pixelated versions of Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and stuff, right? And somebody said, well, we got to make that into a movie. So this was not conceptualized by Sandler and his gang. This was not something that was created for specifically Sandler. It was something that was created and then brought to him. And I think that that's a huge thing that we are going to have to kind of address throughout some of my personal issues with this film. And, you know, the first kind of question where I asked, why does this count as a universe film when it's not even his idea, right? So this movie comes out in 2015, 5 years later. A lot of people are, you know, kind of excited about the idea that this thing got picked up as a film and then immediately kind of just like scratching their heads that Adam Sandler and the gang were the ones asked to kind of carry the torch for it. It comes out at number one, beating Ant-Man. which sounds like a huge deal, except Ant-Man at that point had already been out for 2 months. It was on week 8 and still number 2 in the box office. Do you know? I will give you one guess. I will tell you this. It was 15 weeks out. Do you know what movie came in number 3?
15 weeks out, the movie that came in number 3, 2015. Oof. I honestly don't. I can't think of anything else.
Animated.
It's an animated film? Mm-hmm. Is it Hotel Transylvania 2?
No, that is actually not, because that was earlier in the year. This was Minions.
Minions. Oh,
sorry,
gosh.
Later in the year. Pixels was earlier than Hotel Transylvania.
Yeah, I knew they were sure the same year.
I think they tried for a Halloween, you know, release with Hotel Transylvania, obviously, probably September. But Minions had been out for at this point 4 months and was still holding number 3 at the box office. So it comes out and Pixels comes out, and so it's number 1 with a, you know, but it's not a huge weekend. It's not. It's just, it's crazy to me that it kind of came out at that time, like just early enough to beat like the August blockbuster film, right? But not so early that like it really interfered with things like 4th of July weekend or anything. It was placed very purposefully in not a dead period, but also not like a lively one.
Yeah, that I knew that this came out in the summer, and that is very strange, but in argument for Pixels and like why I think Pixels is a movie that means something to me, 2015 also saw the release of Aloha, a film that I think everybody would like it if we forgot, and something I think we're probably going to have to revisit on the Say Report at some point. Ricky and the Flash.
Oh, man.
And I mean, and just those two, because those are two of the trailers that were on the DVD for Pixels.
No. We can't ignore one of the other ones, because I'm not. Yeah, here's how the sausage is made, folks. Devin texted me as he was watching it, freaking out about these. One of the other previews on that tape was, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul Blart 2. Paul Blart Goes Vegas, right? Like
it's just Paul Blart 2. There's no Vegas included.
Blart's 11? Is that not the like subtitle? What is it? Like,
no, it's just Paul Blart 2. I
can't believe there's no subtitle there.
There's no subtitle. It's insane. Yeah, that's right. Paul Blart 2 is also there. So like this is kind of gearing up to be the year of the Sandlerverse.
The fight is on and he's segueing in. It's Paul Blart. I'm so excited. Yeah, but Paul Blart 2 is coming out this same year.
And I mean, and the other one is I guess, sorry.
No, go ahead.
In the interest of full disclosure, the other two trailers, one of them was Goosebumps, which did well enough to get a sequel film. And I can't prove it, but I'm pretty sure is how we got a Jumanji sequel.
Nice.
Especially one starring Jack Black. And then Hotel Transylvania 2, which I think I just said. So, like, the trailers, some of them made sense, and then some of them didn't make any sense at all. Like, Ricky
yeah,
and the Flash.
I don't know why Aloha. Yeah, Ricky and the Flash or Aloha. I have no idea why they would be on that for previews. But, you know, man, fucking weird year. Yeah, so, like, we're hitting this weird year in cinema as it is. The people are trying. This is, like, kind of the golden age of bitching about how originality is dead. You know, like, this kind of. And Pixels, I don't think, helps that conversation. As much as it is based on, like, this very cute original short film from 5 years earlier, by the time you get to Pixels, the movie, that idea feels very kind of tropey. Like, the idea of, like, let's take this cool video game thing and then put it into the real world and see what that looks like. I straight up have art on my wall that looks like that right now that I bought in, I believe, 2012. So there you go.
Well, that 2012 of it all, I really feel like this film is set in 2012.
Yeah, I don't know exactly when this movie falls. They're kind enough to really give a shout out to the PlayStation 4.
Oh, they love giving PlayStation 4 credit in this movie.
Yeah,
it's a Sony film. I think that it is important to note that this is a film by Sony.
Well, we talked about last week about how the guy that had been kind of producing Adam Sandler films, like the or last week, last episode, about how that all kind of fell to shit because of the failure of Little Nicky and financial. financial failure of Little Nicky. Listen to the episode to see how we feel about it, really. But the idea being that, like, this is the first one that we have watched as a family where Sony's like, we're gonna give you some money, but we're not gonna be the guys to like save your ass when things go sideways. And that's why you don't see just Sony on this. You also see Columbia, right? You also see Columbus. You also see, right? Like, there's
Happy Madison. They are
Happy Madison. Yeah. And I think it's the first time that we see Mr. Sandler in the Happy Madison profile, right? That's his dad in this one. And I think it's the first time we see his dad.
Yes. So it's very interesting also that it's the first Happy Madison produced film that we're talking about in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I mean, there's definitely been other ones, but this is the first one where that's part of the production slides in the beginning.
It's the first time that it's the first time that that matters. Before, Happy Madison just meant, yeah, Adam Sandler's putting his own money in the film, of course. This is the first time that we are watching a movie, because, again, there have been others in between here, where, like, seeing Happy Madison on a movie, first of all, didn't necessarily mean it was going to be an Adam Sandler flick, and then on top of that, we didn't know what that meant in terms of, like, you know, here's what's to come.
Right. I mean, and we'd also be remiss in this facts and figures moment to point out that this was, at the time, the last theatrically released Adam Sandler film before his 4-film exclusivity deal with Netflix kicked in.
Yeah, so it's Pixels, and then literally later that year, we get The Ridiculous Six, the first Netflix-produced Adam Sandler movie out of that deal. So within the same year, we see his last major studio film moving to his first Netflix streaming film.
Which, I mean, there's just so much to unpack. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited to get to something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue. But before
one last thing, though, about the numbers. Sorry. Okay. Oh, sorry, I just want to make sure. No, I just want to make sure one last thing is talked about here. It has a budget of about $88 million. Makes only about $25 million in its first weekend. But when all is said and done, because it does gangbusters internationally, it's huge overseas. We end up with a $250 million movie. So this movie is considered a success by all accounts. Even in America itself, it made $78 million. So it's just kind of under budget. But, like, everybody knows you're going to make that all back in international. And they sure enough did. They fucking blew it out of the water internationally.
That is the saddest thing that I have ever heard. This is why I give you facts and figures. Because if I knew that before I had a microphone in front of me, I would have canceled this recording. Because
I'm sorry, man.
The biggest sin that I see in the film Pixels, the biggest cinnamon, if you will, that I see from the film Pixels, is that this did not get a animated cartoon spinoff, a la the Evolution spinoff or the Mummy spinoff, Men in Black. Like, this film had a clear goal to try to be, I'm ripping this Band-Aid off, and we'll get to it, but I'm ripping the Band-Aid off. This was the first attempt by Sony in the 2010s to create a new Ghostbusters film.
Okay. I think they wanted a franchise for sure. I didn't feel Ghostbusters-y much. Now that you say it, like, I can definitely recognize that. But I will give you this. They wanted a franchise. This feels like the kind of thing that they wanted to revisit. And I think you're right to say that maybe not in a movie. A cartoon show? Perfect. I think that would have been the perfect franchise for Sony, is to go from this into a fucking 52-episode Saturday morning cartoon if it had come forward 12 years earlier.
Yeah, I do. It just feels that way. It feels like all the toyetic stuff that they introduce with this film that is clearly geared towards adults is meant to translate into a cartoon and then translate into living plastic so that the Pixels machine can be out there pumping. And this, you know, talk about shared cinematic universes, which is what the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast is really all about. Coming together of separate companies and universes for a film like Pixels is insane.
I am glad to know that I'm not fucking crazy. Sorry, I was thinking about like Namco and Nintendo and so like on so many levels of what you're talking about, but not least of which the very fundamental level of all of these video game companies just showing up right on screen and allowing their products to show up on screen. And I'm just happy to admit that I'm not out of my fucking mind. I knew Dan Aykroyd was in this movie. I just thought he was the president. I think at some point we talked about Dan Aykroyd being in this movie, and I think on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, and you corrected me. You said, no, because Kevin James is the president. You're thinking of this other movie with Dan Aykroyd being the president. But Dan Aykroyd is in this movie. It's just for, like, a second.
He's the president of the fictional Twin Galaxies in the world of Pixels.
And his skull shows up later, but we'll talk more about
which
that
I
later.
Wonder, I do wonder if that skull, right, that was his payment for being in this film. You're going to drink Crystal Skull vodka.
Yeah. I'll show up for one scene in your movie, but you're going to drink my product right on screen, and you're going to show that thing right to everybody. Sure, we'll drink your shitty vodka, whatever you say, Aykroyd.
All right, Dan Aykroyd. That steep bargain you got going there.
Yeah. Okay, but I think before we get into old new Borrowed Blue, don't we have to do a synopsis of this film?
I have to do a synopsis of this beautiful film. After proving himself the best in the world at Centipede and Galaga while competing at the 1982 Worldwide Video Arcade Championships, all that stands between Sam Brenner and the title of world champion is to prove himself against Eddie, the Fire Blaster Plant, in a game of Donkey Kong. Unfortunately, this is the first time he'll come in second place. Fast forward 30 years, and Sam Brenner works for a Geek Squad knockoff, while his childhood friend, Will Chewy Cooper, has become the president of the freaking United States of America. Resigned to his role as silver medalist, Brenner has given up on trying to succeed and is only focused on making it through each day. But fate has other plans in mind for this loser who's good at old video games. Footage from the 1982 championships were shot into space and discovered by the Veluvians, a peaceful alien race that misinterpret them as a declaration of war and begin shaping their culture around one simple goal, defeating the Earth in these contests of old. After the initial space invasion destroys an Air Force base in Guam, President Cooper loops in Brenner to confirm his darkest fears, that we have been attacked by Galaga. This attack also lands on the radar of Ludlow the Wonder Kid Lamonsoff, a fellow competitor at the 1982 event and conspiracy theorist, who attempts to kidnap Brenner, knowing he is the only one who can help him bring the truth to light, that another attack will happen in 24 hours somewhere in northern India. Unable to avert the catastrophic destruction of the Taj Mahal, President Cooper convinces the armed forces of the validity of the threat from the stars and conscripts Ludlow and Brenner to train a team of Navy SEALs in video combat. However, when the Veluvian forces prove too much for the military, Ludlow and Brenner are forced to take up the joysticks into their own hands and successfully defend London against the threat of Centipede. The only remaining problem? Brenner may be good at some of these classic arcade games, but not all of them. For the team to truly be unstoppable, they're going to need one more member, the Fire Blaster. After meeting some of his demands, Eddie is released from prison and joins a squad of arcaders, and with his seemingly miraculous help, they are able to defeat Pac-Man in New York City. The Veluvian response is a declaration that Earth cheated in this event, thus invalidating the competition, leaving an all-out invasion as the only course of action. Despite being stripped of their weapons, Brenner manages to rally his team to fight for the planet. During this final battle against the alien fleet, it is revealed that Eddie cheated in New York and in fact has been cheating since 1982, proving Brenner the true world champion. Using the newfound confidence of this revelation, Brenner is able to thwart the invasion, ushering in a time of peace between Earth and the Veluvians.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh. Catastrophic. It was so good. I know, that was great. That was phenomenal. I love your wrap ups. That's all.
Thank you.
No. Yeah. So that is. It's a crazy movie, and it's something that I've kind of had to deal with a little bit with Little Nicky, and I think it's becoming worse and worse as the movies come along. Waterboy is also guilty of this. The setups for the movie are so rushed to get to the good stuff. And once we're in the good stuff, we're fine. But, like, I'm only saying this because Pixels commits the biggest sin of them all so far. And the idea being that setting up this world is handled so beautifully in, like, the early scene, right, of them as kids. And that is so wonderfully held. But the second they get to adults, they've like fucking like speed racer it to the plot. And I'm just like, no, I want to spend more time like learning about this world now. Like I want to dedicate as much time to learning about this world now as I did then. There's exposition dumps. There's just all of this stuff that goes on in the really early parts of this movie that made it really kind of just I didn't know why I was there yet. And then there is a very clear moment when it become when it shifts gears again, and I even wrote this down, is it is 22 minutes in, exactly 22 minutes in, this becomes a good Sandler movie. And it is the moment when he is standing outside of the president's office, and she, still not knowing who he is, Violet says to him, is just like, you should go home now. Like, I don't know why they let you in here. And then all of a sudden they're like, the president will see you now. And he's just like, oh, so much
Somebody's
less than
more
yeah,
important.
he does the old school like Adam Sandler voice and like does the whole bit, and I was like, yeah, there we go, that's why I'm here, this is why I paid for my ticket. And so like there's a clear like 5 or 10 minutes there between like old footage to that is just like, okay, what the fuck are we doing now? And I think it's because things have gotten more fantastical, right? Like this has to be the most fantastic, and this is saying something after watching Little Nicky. This has to probably be the most fantastic that these movies have gone. And it is in that like that realization that like this world is just far goofier than I thought, that like I get kind of lost in the exposition. I don't know what's going on. Then the movie clicks, and then it becomes the movie that I know it to be, and then it's a fine experience. But there is definitely a moment in the beginning where I was a little worried.
The only thing that I have to say about that, because you're not wrong, this, like I said, there's this, I found an unexpected depth in rewatching Pixels again, and that is the fact that Brenner, to me, I never really truly understood how broken he is as a person.
Yeah.
And it's because you're not given any time to live in it. You're
In him
only,
breaking.
yeah. You,
Yeah.
you, it moves so quick to want to get to, no, this isn't what people want to watch this movie for. But also, it's his whole character arc. The fact
Yeah.
that because he lost a video game competition, by the way, where both he and his competitor got to a kill screen on Donkey Kong.
Well, not a kill screen, I noted, but I get your
They
point.
got to
They
level
look
22, which is when the game ends.
Yeah, they got to the end of Donkey Kong, quote unquote, the end of Donkey Kong. but I'm not gonna be a nerd about this. I think that's something I also had to kind of resign myself to, though. Like, no joke, is that as much as this movie is a love letter to old school video games, it also is very much coming from the voice of a man that has not touched a video game system in 20 years. So like, there's some stuff that I was like, that's not right exactly how it worked, even in history. But that's okay. Like, you can spout some great shit we read off of Wikipedia. That doesn't actually mean that I had to turn that part of my brain off. I just had to.
I know,
I
and
because
it is the hardest thing about this film
yeah.
because they are dropping things like, this is clearly based on the 1982 build of Galaga, and I'm like, wow, that's impressive. That's an impressive thing for me to go to this Adam Sandler movie and someone name check the fact that the 1982 build of Galaga had these specific glitches, and that's why it's all based on a 1986 re-release of the game now.
Right, and so why couldn't have the Donkey Kong competition just been go until somebody dies? Why did we have to get to the quote unquote end of Donkey Kong? That was just weird to me, because like we all know that Donkey Kong will go on forever until the quote the literal kill screen, where like the CPU cannot keep up with its shit, so you cannot read what's going on, and like that would have been awesome. To have and the thing and I think the thing that really actually kills me about that is we are sitting around the same time that King of Kong comes out. So people even outside of the nerdy video game world are kind of aware of that little piece of like video game trivia, that like Donkey Kong's big secret about its ending, quote unquote, is that actually you can go until like you literally can't read the screen anymore. It was weird. It was just weird.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, they try. They try by making them both play to level 22 and then
Yes.
like, well, we know the
Yeah.
game doesn't work after this anymore, so this is
Right.
where we're gonna judge by.
It pulls the whiz. It
Yeah.
where it gives an arbitrary goal for them to hit. And I appreciate that. It was just that like if you're gonna go hard in these like weird facts and figures, like back it up in like some of your other shit as well. But that's what I mean, is I just had to turn that part of myself off. And I think that even in that moment, I realized that, and I was able to, and I still really enjoy, I really, really enjoy the setup of this movie with them as kids and going to this arcade. Time means fucking nothing, because supposedly this is the first day this arcade has ever opened up. Then suddenly they're in a hotel like lobby, like in a competition. Then suddenly they're playing like the fucking world champs. It's just like, okay, all right, time means nothing so far, but that's all right.
Well, I mean, it does say it's summer 1982. And then they go to the arcade because it just opened. So I could believe that it opened the last week of May, maybe even the first week of June. Right, and then the World Video Arcade Championships, the Arcade World Championships, take place on July 26th, 1982. Like, that's prominently shown on the flyer. So we don't know how much time is being passed in the montage of Brenner playing games in right. that arcade. And you right. know, you've been to an arcade, you lose track of time. It's like a casino for children.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
The crazy thing is that they are all 13 years old.
Yeah.
That, like, it's all 13-year-olds. There's nobody, like, potentially older who's part of it. It's three 13-year-olds, and then Ludlow is 5 years younger than them at 8. And that thank you credits for giving me ages of characters. I'm gonna thank Pixels for that. But yeah, it's the games of it all is very hard to comprehend with. And then also that we're so rushed to get to, you know, them fighting Pac-Man in New York that
yeah.
we're not really gonna care about the other stuff along the way. But it's big character arc stuff.
Yeah. Him, so Sandler plays for the first time a really kind of mellow, real, down to earth character, and like, it's noticeable that this is after now he has kind of done his rounds through the dramatic, right? Like, The Cobbler comes out earlier this year, Punch Drunk Love was before this, was somewhere between this and Little Nicky. What's the other one, the 9/11 one that he does with Don Cheadle? Stand By Me.
It's not Stand By Me, it's something like that.
Yeah. Hold
I was
on,
just
wait,
looking
I
at it
here.
As a, oh my God, that's an Adam Sandler movie that I always, Rain Over Me.
Rain Over Me, that's
whoa,
what it is, yeah.
I don't know where that came from. I'm a little scared.
Yeah, but like, even some of his more like heavily dramatic or more relatable romantic comedies are in here, right? Like Spanglish and 51st Dates and stuff like that are all in this time period. So what I mean is like Sandler has been working to kind of try something new for a while now. Since Little Nicky into this movie, he has been kind of trying to figure out how to, you know, for lack of a better term, better himself as an actor in these films. And I think that we see in this movie him really try and give it a go to be something different for this level of film for him.
Yeah, it's the what I know wrote what I wrote in my notes was I love how reserved the character of Sam Brenner is.
Yeah.
And there are little moments where he tries to do the Sandler stuff, like, "Oh, she went from zero to psycho in 3.4 seconds flat." Like, it's like, "What was that? That doesn't sound like something Sam Brenner would say." That sounds like Adam Sandler kind of bleeding through the mask of this character. Another one that really hits me is, oh, they can sell it at Barnes and Unstable. Like, and it's like, oh, was that written? And was that written by somebody's like, this is something Adam Sandler would say. And not
I
something
like
that Sam Brenner would say.
No, yeah. What I honestly feel like is like punch up on set punch up of them being like, give us a couple of different reads on this. What do you want to try? Right, which we inevitably see in Apatow movies being literally like 70% of the script. Right, but the idea of like letting Sandler kind of riff in a couple of moments, I think, is really apparent. There's also another moment when he goes, it's actually a. a super smart joke that I really enjoyed. The Space Invaders one that he says to Ludlow when he's just like, "You really into Space Invaders lately? Why? Because you're invading my space. Back up a minute." And I was just like, "All right, I'll give you that." That was very Rodney Dangerfield-esque. Like, and as we talked about with Little Nicky, like clearly that love for right Rodney Dangerfield kind of bleeding through in some of those moments. But yeah, there's a lot of little moments where Sandler riffs and it feels almost out of character. And you could tell it was because they kind of put him on the spot to be like, I don't know, this time tell a joke, you know?
Where like Adam Sandler probably came to this film like, wow, this is a film about somebody in arrested development because of the one loss that he experienced in his life. And now he doesn't even want to try anymore because he never wants to lose again. I could really bring some depth to this character. What do you mean just like make up a joke? I thought I was acting here.
Yeah.
We got Chris Columbus. We got the Harry Potter guy, right?
Well, like, and the idea of being like, oh, this is my chance. And you see this a lot. The movie that I actually put it on the same level with a lot is a few years earlier, he does the Disney movie Bedtime Stories. Do you remember that one?
Of course, I remember Bedtime Stories.
And so there's this beautiful idea of being able to come into a set with a written script that is funny and like you're going to hit your audience that you know, but you also like you can dedicate yourself to just that character on the page. And I feel like exactly like you're saying, I'm just kind of reiterating what you're saying, is it feels very clear that there are these moments where they then turn to him and we're like, all right, you know, we wrote this joke, but why don't you try a few more and we'll see what's funnier. And he's just like, okay. And like on the spot has to kind of make up these moments for it. And I'm not saying that he's not good at it or not comfortable at it. It's just this idea that like, it doesn't fit with the way that Sam Brenner goes through life to have these like weird little off the cuff, like bizarre comments about people. It just doesn't fit some of the better stuff that we see earlier in the movie. The entire conversation that he has when he first shows up at Violet's house with what's Violet's son's name?
Maddie.
Maddie, right? That entire conversation that he has with Maddie, starting at the door that we so aptly recreated at the beginning of the episode, but also all the way through, like talking to Maddie about the divorce and stuff. That is some of the best Adam Sandler acting that we have seen in our movies since we've started this podcast. Like, I will admit there's been better acting in other movies that we haven't addressed yet, but as far as the Sandler universe stuff goes, that stuff was pretty choice.
Yeah, he is on top of his game in that moment, without a doubt. It's wonderful is the word I'm going to use.
Yeah.
It really, like, you see how he wins that kid over.
Yeah.
Because, like, at the beginning, he's just, like, you see it, like you said, we recreated it. Like, that kid, he's just viewing him as nothing, right? Like, this guy just, he's here to serve a purpose, and that's to install all this stuff that my parents are throwing at me because they're going through a divorce. And then when he approaches him and speaks to him on a human level, not like an adult to a child, that instant connection is made.
Yeah.
And
that matters, because in the rest of the movie, there's moments where Maddie is like key to a scene or key to a moment. And we wouldn't believe that this kid that he's only met once, really, that he cared that much about, if we didn't get that good chunk of time with Maddie in that moment to really see their relationship pretty much click. But what I also really love about that moment is like Sam Brenner has a really good way of just breaking through people's walls. Like he's friendly. He's fun to be around. And we see that even in young Sam Brenner. And like, I'll give all credit to the kid that plays the younger version of him. Like the ways in which he like addresses Ludlow when he first meets him, or when they first go to the arcade and like he's in on that shit. Like it's Sam Brenner as a character is like just a cool dude, like a nice guy to just be around. And the fact that they made that a character that has no real like personality attributes that I dislike, and I will point directly to what we're talking about, like that we've seen in the guys like Happy or Billy or Nicky. Well, maybe not so much Nicky. Nicky was just kind of innocent. He was just a bit dopey about some things, but there were things that like were straight up assholish about Billy, straight up assholish about Happy, right? And that idea that in this one, he's just a good dude. Like he just doesn't believe in himself. He's shitty to himself, but he's not shitty to anybody around him. And that is established from moment one.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the whole arc of him with Lud is wonderful. That whole, well, you can hang out with us, right? And it's really strange because it's like some of those asshole traits that would usually be on an Adam Sandler character have mm-hmm. been peeled off and applied to the Kevin James character.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
like the mean thing yeah. to Lud about, wow, you just have no friends, right? Like Billy Madison would have said that before, but then still said, well, you can hang out with us because they want you to have your cake and eat it too. But here, since the addition of Kevin James, and this will be an interesting strain to look for as we go through the Adam Sandler cinematic universe further, I think you notice that Kevin James takes on a lot of those more assholish traits to make the Adam Sandler character more pure.
I will call out a movie that we have not watched yet, and I don't know when we'll get to it, but I would challenge that only in Chuck and Larry.
And already have a response as to why you're wrong.
Fair enough. But here's the thing: I think this is the time to do it because we've got to talk about Kevin James, because this is like when I talked about the idea that him being introduced in this film, not introduced in this film to the universe, but introduced to the podcast, at least in this film. Right. The idea being that Kevin James and Adam Sandler as a duo is a revelation and possibly the closest that we could get to God, if Chris Farley was still around. And I do not mean that as in like Kevin James isn't good enough. And I do not mean that in like we're settling for Kevin James. Like, I want to make sure that that's clear. It's just that I feel like we would have gotten to this point in Sandler's career where he realized he needed a straight man. He needed a guy to like, he needed to kind of split that shittiness from himself in order to keep doing what he was doing. And I think we would have gotten there 5 years sooner if Farley had stayed around. Like, if it's this beautiful relationship between the two of them in all of the movies that they're in, where what Sandler and James do is they play off of each other and they give each other the ability to be the other guy. There's this chance for them to kind of just like shine in relation to, and like the relationship is perfect. It's almost like watching Abbott and Costello. It's a shame that Kevin James came this late into Sandler's life, because like 10 years earlier and every movie would have been a Kevin James Adam Sandler movie. Waterboy would have had two characters in it. Little Nicky would have had two characters in it. You know what I mean?
I do. And I mean, not discounting the people that were there for Adam Sandler to peel it off. And actually, it's really interesting that you talk about some of the more negative traits being peeled off and applied to Chris Farley, because you look at Billy Madison, as soon as Billy starts to have his turn to no longer hold on to the dickish qualities, that's when you introduce Chris Farley as the bus driver.
Yeah, even to that point, Artie Lang and Norm Macdonald, even throughout the movie.
It's not like, Artie Lang.
It's not Artie Lang.
It's not Artie Lang. I know why you thought it was Dirty Work. Yeah. No, you have those two to show that, like, this is where he comes from. But then the interesting thing with those two characters is that in lieu of Billy, they're eating those sandwiches with Chris Farley.
Eating those sandwiches. Yeah, exactly.
It's that damn Sasquatch. It's just something that's a really, really interesting thing that Siege.
Like there's no Sandler's never hidden the fact of how much he loved Farley and how much he has really kind of changed as a human since he lost him. Right. And like that's well documented. But I think that I think we would have gotten a Paul Blart with Chris Farley in it. Like, and again, it would have been 2005 when we got it, and that would have been choice, right? It's a shame that we got it 10 years later, and it's Kevin James, who at that point in his career didn't need to be doing that kind of comedy, but like knew that it was, you know, it was the best way to make sure that he was still working. I love the Kevin James Adam Sandler relationship, but I cannot, as a child of the 90s, I cannot view it and not wish that it had been Chris Farley around longer for that stuff.
I get that. I can understand it. It's a really interesting analog to draw, because like it's almost super planted what Chris Farley and Adam Sandler were doing for me, just because we've had it for so much longer.
Yeah.
Just because we like the amount of time that Chris and Adam got to work together has been almost doubled by the amount of time that Kevin and Adam have gotten to work together.
To that point, imagine Lunch Ladies redone with Kevin James playing the lunch lady. It would still be hilarious. It would just be a different element than the, like, sexy relationship the two of them had in that moment, right?
It would still be hilarious, but it would be a different kind of hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Oof. All right. This is some good stuff. And I don't want to pare it down, but I think it's time for a little thing that we call something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue.
All right.
And I'm going to let you go first on the new.
Okay. So we've called out Kevin James already, so I'm going to kick that one off the list. I'm sorry if that's yours, and we can definitely talk more about it if you want. Okay, that's good, because I actually have a second thing for it. I wrote Kevin James at first because it was the obvious answer when I saw the credits roll, but the opening credits roll. But actually, I think the thing that I really want to point out is the new thing that's introduced in this movie for Sandler films going forward is this is the first time that we've really witnessed Over the Hill Sandler. This is the first time that we've seen old man Sandler with his looking back, and I'll talk more about nostalgia later, but the idea being that he's no longer playing the young guy helping out his grandma. He's playing the older guy helping out this love interest or child that he's interested in. You know what I mean? Like there's a clear switch in Sandler's career when he grows up. And I don't mean that he gets mature. I just mean that his characters start focusing on what an old man would focus on. And I think this is the first time we've witnessed that.
To support that, this is the first movie we've watched where Adam Sandler is divorced. His character is divorced.
Okay.
And that is another thing where, if you're trying to appeal to your age group, the bulk of people the age that Adam Sandler is in this film, which, oh my god, it's 43 if it's 30 years later, probably, right? If they feel like they're a failure, they have a divorce under their belt.
That's at least one thing that is part of it for sure. Yeah.
Like, it's so there was this interesting thing where I'm like, oh, Adam Sandler's not been divorced before in the ASCU films. Like, there are plenty of movies where it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to explore those films. But yeah, that is interesting. I knew that he was getting older, but you're right. It is an over the hill Adam Sandler that we come to in Pixels. And that's almost forgotten because of how youthful playing the games he played when he was 13 makes him.
Yeah.
Whew.
Man. Okay. So something old.
I haven't done my something new.
Oh, I thought that was your something
new. No. My something new is to support that. My something new is fucking aliens. Capital A-L-I-E-N-S. Underlined aliens.
Yeah, man.
Because we have already discussed the existence of a heaven and a hell and for real magic in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. But that is all just localized around our own macrocosm that is the planet Earth. This proves that there is life out there in further stars.
Yes.
The planet Valula has life, and they don't understand video games.
Oh, man. Yeah, man. Aliens exist in this universe. Yep.
All right. So something old. I'll go first here. The first thing that I wrote down, we already touched on it, is the fact that he goes, somebody's more important. And revisiting Happy Gilmore is, I think, the strongest argument for a film being part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
He definitely borrows from himself in that moment, for sure.
I mean, so that's the something old, because the borrowed is from, cinema in general. But for other things, he uses the term buffoon to refer to himself and Ludlow when talking to the Navy SEALs. And, that's crazy, because this is what a buffoon looks like in their 40s. But look at what a buffoon looked like in their 20s.
Man, yeah. So I think the big thing for me that is very Adam Sandler story-esque in a lot of what happens in this movie, the old really has to come down to power-hungry white dudes he really is not afraid to put a thing on display, and it might be a very shallow view of a thing, but he is never afraid to like call out something that he thinks is stupid. So in this, like it's government stuff that we see a bunch of. We see army dudes, we see a Brian Cox as the general, that he walks in and he's like, "Can somebody take the remote control away from Grandpa before he blows us all to hell?" Like that moment when he walks in the room, I was like, "Fuck yeah!" Like again, this was just after I fell back in love with the idea that this was an Adam Sandler movie, but his moment where he first walks in the room and into the war room was really good. But also the way that he acts with Sean Bean later and stuff like that, like there's a lot of stuff on display here of him just being like you guys are always so quick to jump to conclusions A, B, and C when really it might be something else, right? And that is what I thought was really interesting about this movie, is that in a lot of other Adam Sandler films that we've watched, it's one person that everything is directed at, and there's not really like a major like villain that we could point to in this movie. Even Brian Cox or Sean Bean, like they're not villainous in anything that they do, right? They never act maliciously, they never act out of line. The only person you could maybe point to would be Fireblaster, but then like Eddie turns out to also be on their side. Like he's never a antagonist to the point where he's a villain, right?
Right,
So
he's more of a rival, a cheeky
right.
rival.
Right. And so like there's this, so that's what I, so like this movie, for all of its lack of villains, does not shy away from Sandler's ability to put like shitty white old white dudes on display.
Agreed. It really does kind of call to task the industrial complex.
I mean, like, and that's the joke, right? As a lot of his movies do. I mean, even down to Billy Madison, the reason that he hates Eric so much is that Eric is this like this evil capitalist, and I mean, then you have Shooter McGavin, who's just this like this figure who's representative of the boys' club, you know? And like, I mean, little Nicky had Tiny Lister for like half the movie, but then Tiny Lister's taken out of the picture, and what were we left with? We're left with what's his nuts, the other
Reese
brother there.
Evans. Oh, or do you
Yeah,
want the
yes. No,
character's
I want the
name?
character's name after I said Tiny Lister.
I have to go back in my notes.
Yeah, no, but that's what I mean, right? Is there's this there's it always comes down to there's just there are problems in these stories that are just elevated and pushed by shitty white dudes. And in some non-cinematic movies that we have not talked about, sometimes Sandler's not afraid to put himself in that role, you know? Like I'm looking at you, Click. Like he is willing to play the shitty white antagonist in those movies. But like old white dudes being like the bad guy in his films he's never shied away from that, even in a movie where you can't point to a direct villain. There's still elements of that.
I'll agree. I'll agree, and I'll thumbs it up. And just because it's fun to do this, right? I haven't done it much, but I'm gonna sprinkle a little bit of extra old and just mention True by Spada Ballet. And maybe that will flower into something later on in our
Ooh,
excursions back into the Adam
the
Sandler
seeds have been
cinematic
planted.
universe. Which brings us to Borrowed. And do you mind if I go first here? Because I don't want you to take mine.
Yeah, no. Go ahead.
I mean, it's hard not to look at King of Kong, but again, we've already name dropped King of Kong. But King of Kong, I mean, Billy Mitchell, that is the big basis for the Fire Blaster.
I used to work on Billy Mitchell Road. Did I ever tell you that?
No, that is the craziest thing I have ever heard.
When I worked for Netflix, they were based on a company, and its address was Billy Mitchell Road, a road named for Billy Mitchell after he won a bunch of shit in the 80s for video game stuff. Out here in Utah, they named a road after him in an industrial complex just to like, you know, do that shitty thing that they do where they're like, "We name this day after you in 2020, after 2020, that state is not named after you." It was that same idea. Like, we're gonna name a road after you. It's 5 feet long and it's in this industrial complex where nobody lives, so it's not like anybody has an address on Billy Mitchell Road, but yep, I worked on Billy Mitchell Road.
Wow, that puts things into perspective. But the other thing that I'm going to say they borrowed from, this whole movie kind of feels like Anthology of Interest number two, when Fry wishes if everything were video games. Thank you, Futurama, for
Yeah, for sure.
like
No,
just
I
inspiring whole swaths of pixels.
for sure. There's that. And I will tell you that the my big thing that I pointed to for Borrowed is killer video games, the idea of like the video games have turned against us, which is such a trope in things. This is the twist this time, I think, is the fact that it is classic video games, and there is a there's a narrative reason why it's not like horrific, although it's still kind of horrific, and we'll talk more about that. But the idea being of like killer video games, I don't think is anything new. I put that down as my major borrowed. But the other element that I want to point to is there's also a super heavy element of the vid whiz, and I don't mean just like the whiz for like for all
The
intents and
wizard,
purposes.
the wizard.
I don't mean the wizard. I don't mean just the wizard, because that is a perfect example of it. But I mean, this is something that's present earlier than that, even in war games.
I mean, I think there's a reason why Pixel sticks with me, and it's because it's sort of like the hackers of 20 years later.
Yep. Yeah. But like the idea that somebody who is good at computers, whittle that down a little bit to video games, is going to save the day because of their ability with video games, and we underestimated them because they were just into video games. It's such a like old stupid trope, but this movie just like rides it. Like this, that is the point of this entire movie. And to the detriment where he's just constantly being like, you know, nerds kiss the best. Like we're nerds, get it? Nerds are the best. Nerds will save the world. And it's just like that. That's when this movie gets super cringy for me. It feels very old man, very, dare I say, boomerish when in those moments.
Yeah, that's why this movie I think is also a little hard for me, is that like the idea of like video games mattering in the world, that'd be
Yeah.
nice. I really wish that could happen for real, but I don't want
But
to
we
get too
do know that
weepy.
it happens for real. Like there's this sense that kind of stuff doesn't matter, but we're learning more and more that like the guys that are willing to sit around and at 15 program their own mods for video games, or even hell build full from the ground up their own video games, those are the guys that end up going on to invent fucking like robots for MIT and shit. Like we're not stupid. Those people are important and celebrated nowadays. As much as Chuck Lorre wants to make a joke out of them, like no, like those dudes are the ones that are gonna make sure we can colonize Mars before we all die here on Earth. Like we've already hit a point, and I think even in 2015 this was true. We've already started to hit a point where people that liked a video game when they were a kid were not automatically seen as losers when they were 40. But this movie would have us believe otherwise.
Yeah, and I actually think that that's a big part of the Brenner character, is the fact that only losers like video games, because he's a loser because he lost at a video game.
Right.
And that's his only frame of reference for video games.
Yeah.
All right, which brings us to something blue. And I'm gonna let you go first, because I think mine's a little obvious. So hopefully
Mine
you got something
is
more fun.
literally whatever Josh Gad is doing in this movie. My entire note is whatever it is Josh Gad is doing. Down to specifically like the moment that it all culminates, and this is not the only example of it, it's just the best example of it, when Lady Lisa becomes a actual factual trophy, named trophy at the end of this movie, when somebody says, well, but that one's a trophy, we get to keep those, right? And then it turns into Lady Lisa for Josh Gad for this movie. Everything about his character and his motivations in this film, every second I was just like, ooh,
Cool. Cool. I have Inky. I wrote down Inky
All right.
because I wanted to make a Pac-Man or a reference. And Inky is sort of my favorite. He's Speedy. Speedy is his nickname. So he's fast and he's a little unpredictable. So Inky's kind of blue, but
I was going to say, if you didn't name one of the cars after the power pellet pull, what are you doing with this movie? I'm so happy that that's what you chose.
of course. I mean, there's so many other blue things in this, but I'd like to address something from your borrowed that is kind of blue. The worst part about this film for me is that Adam Sandler's definition of nerd seems to be purely fueled by the film Revenge of the Nerds.
Huh. Okay.
I mean
Okay.
that like nerds kiss better because it's all we think about. Like, that's why Lewis was good at sex. That's why she married her rapist. It's every time Adam Sandler uses the word nerds and tries to make it like a sexual bonus, to being a nerd, I'm like, oh, that is hard to hear in 2021.
Well, and what's weird about that is, like, if I looked back on young Adam Sandler now, even 2015, I would have said, yeah, you were a nerd when you were a kid. Like, you were into a very specific thing, and you were hardcore into it, and that was comedy. So you were a comedy nerd. And I think maybe what we're seeing here is a, for lack of a better term, I guess, boomer understanding of the word nerd and that idea that it means this very specific thing, the guy with the pocket protector, the guy with the robots, the guy with the computer, right? When that's not what nerd means. Nerd means somebody that is so into a very specific hobby to the point where it becomes like a huge part of their life. That's me paraphrasing, but that's the general idea, right? So you can be a comedy nerd. You can be a football nerd. You can be a surfer nerd. But, like, he is a nerd. He's a video game nerd. So, like, it's not that he's not one in this movie. It's just this idea that he thinks that's the only definition of it. And I don't mean to pin this entirely on Sandler, because as I've mentioned before, I don't feel that this is a I don't think we can lay this movie at the feet of Sandler like we could with Little Nicky, like we could with Waterboy or any movie that we've talked about so far. This is the first time where I think this movie is kind of something that we can point at like a bunch of people involved and be like, you didn't, what are you doing? Christopher Columbus included, like the director of this film, who has gone on and before this did many a wonderful movie that is going to like shape my life. There's definitely some stuff that comes through in this film that I'm just like, you don't actually, you thought it was just cool to like be in on the meme of video games at this time, but like you have no fucking clue what's going on here. It's hard for me to act like that and not like call myself out for being fucking gatekeepery or bullshitty or like intellectual about that shit. But like there's very much this element the entire time where it feels like somebody walking in the room and being like, y'all like video games? Let's talk about Donkey Kong. And it's like that. I actually am not huge into Donkey Kong. Like I was way much more of a Pac-Man dude. Well, I could talk about some Puck-Man. Let's do that. And it's like, great. You looked at Wikipedia for a second. Calm the fuck down. Like there's this feeling of constantly being pandered to in this movie that really kind of just feels cringy in a lot of moments.
Yeah. And that's what those moments that you mentioned earlier that you have to shut your brain off to. Like, I know that I'm being pandered to, but sometimes it's something so specific that it works for me, like the 1982 Build of Galaga conversation. Yes. But then it is something like they play to level 22 of Donkey Kong. And I'm like, oh, so just casually, these two kids got a kill screen on Donkey Kong. And nobody's losing their fucking minds at this competition? Like, and also got pretty good scores, considering at the time, I doubt either of these kids were thinking about the point shaving, like, ways to play Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong is a game that has been played and played and mapped out and understood to the fact that, like, the random comment, where it's like, the barrels become so random, there's no pattern. Like, people have learned the patterns of the barrels at the higher levels. Like, yeah. Now, I don't want your propaganda, Fire Blaster.
But I will give them that if they want to place this in 82, that's a decent enough time to have these younger 10-year-old kids talking about it in this way, right? Like, yeah. this idea that these younger kids in 1982 did feel like Donkey Kong is an unsolvable puzzle worked for me. That's not the stuff that felt weird. The stuff that felt weird was later on when just, like, when there is this comment made about, like, the 1982 version of Galaga. And, like, we didn't need that. There are a bunch of, like, fucking, like, army dudes. Just say to them, it's this video game I liked. And I get the point. It's just when they want to drive home how fucking in the know they are, to anybody in the know, it feels weird. And anybody out of the know, it feels unnecessary. So, like, who are they winning over in those moments?
See, Jim, you just said it's fucking weird, right? Those were the words you used. I need to rip the Bandoid. The Bandoid? That's my favorite game, is Bandoids. It's from Namco. The Band-Aid off on the worst part of this film. Yeah, the part of this film that keeps me from saying I absolutely love Pixels. The part of this film that would keep me from watching it every Friday for an entire year, the way that I have done some other films. And that is the fact that not only does it claim that there are cheat codes in Pac-Man, such as a super speed cheat code, but then that somehow Eddie Plant is able to use these cheat codes in real life.
Yeah, it's never... I kept expecting them to say, oh, you cut through an alley, and that's not the point of the game. But no, their legitimate reasoning is he is able to somehow use super speed in real life.
He is able to use what is written on his glasses is the Konami code, but with an asterisk instead of start, which is... It's actually... Oh, I just got it. I just got what it is. It's up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, asterisk, T. So that represents start. Holy fuck. I hate myself right now. I'm doing an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, and I've just realized something so much that it made me hate myself and hurt my heart just a little bit. Oh, man. But
shit. We could all be here for this.
I'm going to crawl back from it. I'm going to crawl back. And here's me crawling back. Is it bothers the fuck out of me every time. Every time I watch this movie, it gets to the scene where it's revealed that Fire Blaster has been cheating because he has scratched codes into his magic sunglasses. And I'm like, all right, but then how did he do it in real life? And because of the work we've done in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, I might be able to justify it in that the Fire Blaster is a wizard and perhaps he came from the moon.
I mean, look, magic is real at this point.
Magic
is
real,
right?
Magic
and aliens, man. Like, there's, yeah, but I, maybe that's more to the point, right? Is the idea that not only are aliens real in this movie, but we have also learned that, like, magic has to be real because he does an incantation that he scratches into an object he wears on his head that allows him super speed. Yeah, man, like there's a lot of stuff that just happens in this movie. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna get the one big complaint that I have about this movie that really makes it feel not like an Adam Sandler movie to me out of the way now, because then we can just like start shooting the shit about the things that we like about this movie.
Love it.
This movie feels empty. Period. Stop. That is the end. There is a thing in Adam Sandler movies that we have talked about where there is a world that they build that feels phenomenal. And then we started to learn that those worlds intersect and suddenly maybe they were one world. And this movie, the reason that I'm so hesitant to talk about it being in the cinematic universe is it doesn't feel like it's part of any universe, not even its own, right? Like there's this sense that like there's no fun side characters that we're following the whole time, you know, like Tithead and the beast, the demon that they were in love that entire movie, and the more you saw them, that like every time you saw them their relationship progressed, there was a story going on there. Or like even in Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore is what I'm thinking of, where his boss that we learn about in the prologue of that movie shows up halfway through the movie to like cheer him on, and then in the finale of that movie is actually like a hero in the moment and like saves his finale, right? So that dude we see have in three scenes have this phenomenal character arc, right? Played wonderfully by Joss. Like there's none of that in this movie. We don't get to see anybody fun. Even Alan Colbert, right?
Colbert, yeah.
Yeah, like
covert, as I say.
But he's first of all, first time that I saw him listed as an EP on one of the films, and that may have come earlier, but like good on him. Like this is when he's in on Happy Madison. But even he shows up, like you said, just once in the background. Like he's not around. He's not a fun guy that we can talk about. He literally shows up in like a wig and a bad beard, like fake beard, for a second to yell at Kevin James, and that's the end of it. Right?
Jonathan is apparently security at the White House. and I was just like, really? John Lagerin is in this movie? Because I really thought that the only thing that Adam was able to bring with him to this film was Kevin James and his family.
And why was and if he is, why is he not the dude that he talks to when he goes into the room?
Yeah.
When he's like, hey, keep the riffraff out. Like, why is that not his friend who can react to him in a comforting, fun way? Why is it instead this random extra that was not expecting a line and clearly was not expecting a line thrown at him in the ways in which he reacts to the camera?
Like, why isn't he... Like, we know a lot about, based on television, we know that there's usually a specific Secret Service detail assigned to the president. Why isn't he the guy assigned to Will Cooper as the president?
I mean, I'd even take the joke that there is one dude who is at the bottom of the food chain assigned to fucking Brenner. Because Brenner's the bestie who just follows him around all the time. Well, you show up at the White House all the time. We felt it was best that we just put a detail on you. And it is this dude that we all hate. And there it is. Then you have the relationship between the two of them for the whole movie.
Right. I mean, the central difference, and then I guess the last one, I've struggled to think of the time to bring it up. Because as much as I love Michelle Moynihan, and I do. Mm-hmm. I do love Michelle Moynihan. I think she's a great actress. I think of the Moynihans, she's my preferred Moynihan. No offense, okay. Bridget. You were in Coyote Ugly, and I love you for that eternally. But Blue Bloods, I'd have to sit down and watch all 11 seasons. And that just sounds
Bobby
like a big
commitment. Is this a family? Do I need to know about
no,
this?
No, Bobby is not part of those Moynihans.
Okay.
As
okay.
far as I know, he Other might Moynihans. Be. But, the Moynihans that I... is Bridget and Michelle. And Michelle is... generally my preferred Moynihan, but she didn't come up in my synopsis because she feels like such an add-on to this film, like an almost unnecessary. We need him to have a relationship with a kid, but we don't want to make him a father. So let's introduce a divorcee who happens to work at DARPA. Like, it just feels like she's just there to check a box.
Well, she's better than what is her name? Jane Krakowski, who we are told weirdly in this scene between Brenner and Chewie that, like, oh, your wife hates you. My wife doesn't hate me. She just doesn't get it. And then for the rest of the movie, Jane Krakowski, who plays his wife, is nothing but loving and supportive and there for him every moment. So what the fuck was that moment all about in the beginning of the movie? Like, there's moments of this film that feel like they were written and then rewritten, and they didn't bother to go back and do reshoots to cover their asses.
I mean, I could explain the thing with Jane Krakowski. All those times where she is happy and supportive, they are together. Where I think her actual, like, anger is that she can't have those moments with him all the time because he is the president of the United States.
Oh, sure. And we're given that exposition dump from Brenner when he says to her, when he says to Chewie, like, you know, you want my advice, put your phone down, just spend some time with your family. Things like, and like, okay. But like, we never like show, don't tell, like, don't tell me that's the issue with the two of them. And then suddenly the issue is solved. Like, show me those moments where he's being too on the job. And Jane Krakowski is like disappointed because like when they first showed up and they were doing the cake thing together, like there's that moment where Chewie and his wife are doing the cake sexy thing, but they're like rubbing frosting all over each other and they're kissing each other. And then somehow that's a bad thing. Fuck that. I don't know what the hell that was all about.
Well, because
but
he's
anyway.
Not focused on, like, that's the thing. That's what I'm talking about. There's no depth. There's all these moments for like real emotional depth. And they're like, we're dealing with an alien invasion. And what you're doing is spending time with your wife. And it's like, yeah, but that's what a normal human would do. He's like, try
the barrel of the end of the fucking world. Yeah, I'm going to go make a cake with my wife, you asshole.
Yeah, for like 5 minutes, too. Like, it's like half an hour we had fun doing this cake. Yeah. And then I'm in fucking London where we're fighting against a thing with experimental weapons technology that we don't know is going to work. I mean, yeah. And I hate the Voluvians, right? I also love that I have brought myself to the fact that... I can say that name so casually now because before this episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, I didn't know the name of the invading alien race, even though Madonna tells us. No, oh, Reagan tells us. I didn't know. It didn't matter. It didn't matter to me. But then I learned it And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that they attack with Galaga and then they declare we're in competition. I hate that. I hate that as a plot point of this movie, that like we're in a competition. We just won the first round, idiots. And then they're gonna be at the end of it say, you cheated. No, you guys cheated by breaking the rules of engagement.
I will say that they understood what had come to them as a declaration of war, so believing that these people were already ready for it is not a far stretch, but like drop a line for that, right? Like what you're pointing to is not unmerited, because this movie never gives you any indication that like they were invading first to defend themselves, but like the story kind of implies that they were under the impression that if they did not act fast, we were going to destroy them.
Yeah, so I get that. But then there's also the fact that sometimes they clearly represent the villain of the video games. They are the ships from Galaga, and then they're the paddles from Breakout.
Right.
And the paddle is the good guy in Breakout. The bricks are the bad guy in Breakout. And then in Centipede, they're the centipedes. And then Pac-Man, they're Pac-Man. So it's like, pick a lane. Are you the bad guys or are you the good guys? Or does none of this fucking matter? And that's the big answer, is that none of it fucking matters. All of it is in service of a plot.
Yeah.
And I mean, that
Not
is.
even a not even a solid plot, a pretty basic skeleton of a plot in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like, and that is the biggest crime against this being an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. That's the emptiness that you're talking about. And I brought up Bridget Moynihan and then I got derailed. That role was first offered to Jennifer Aniston, and on the heels of Just Go With It, I think that if it had been Jennifer Aniston in that role, then that becomes a much bigger Julianne Moore in Evolution style character.
Yeah,
And
for sure.
it's just like, I hate that I know that like it was, we're gonna bring in Jennifer Aniston, and then if Adam Sandler has the lead and the leading lady are people who are in his corner, I feel like he could do a little bit more to make this that stronger Adam Sandler cinematic universe film.
Maybe I will venture to say that I don't think he wants it to be. I don't like, I think one of the biggest issues that in that emptiness, I think one of the biggest things like leading to that is that there's a lot going on in this movie that feels like Adam Sandler is not as we talked about in past films where he was there to make a movie with his friends, where he was there to have a good time. This just feels like Adam Sandler at work. And I'm not saying that he's not putting the work in, and I'm not saying that he's not having a good time. I don't think anybody mistreated him on this movie or any shit like that. But there is definitely clearly not the same element of just like, yeah, let's do 20 takes and get beers after. Like that just doesn't exist on a set. And I put a lot of that on somebody like Chris Columbus directing your film. Like when you're working with somebody that is at that caliber of filmmaking, that is at that level of I consider directing an art. Like you kind of don't get to have the kind of fun that Sandler normally has on his sets. And you know, like, and I don't mean to make it sound like I think Chris Columbus is like a fucking asshole, but like there's a big difference between somebody like Christopher Nolan directing your movie and just like fucking Tim Burton directing your movie, right? Like there's a different feel to the set, right? In that same vein, like having somebody like Chris Columbus on your set is very different than having like your fucking buddy that's also like producing your film with you, directing your movie.
It really, and I think, I wonder, right? So this is all conjecture, right? If Adam Sandler agrees to do Pixels because it's this chance to work with Christopher Columbus. And we know, right? He is in the dramatic period of his career, right?
He stretched his legs, yeah, for
Yeah.
sure. Yeah.
So he stretched that. He knows that, like, it's something that I'm capable of doing. And then he says, all right, so I'm doing this Pixels movie with Chris Columbus. He's this great director. And then he has to read the script, right? And you see, if you're reading the script, this broken character who finds a way to fix that and then go on to live a happy life. And then all of that is taken away because on set, we have Adam Sandler in the video game movie. And that becomes just a paycheck for Adam Sandler. And that's sad.
Yeah. But like I said, I don't want to focus on those elements because...
No, but it's a good point. It is a worthwhile point, man. And I'm...
Right. And just as we're here in like the actual penultimate episode of what we're going to talk about for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, it's interesting to me that we've hit this movie. And I think it's important that we did, because I think this highlights the trajectory of his career. Like, we hit a point where he was making these movies like the Grown Ups films, like this, producing things like Paul Blart, where, like, you know, at this point, it's kind of hard to look at his films and not think that there's more here about the paycheck than it is about the making the movie thing. And that's where, as actual Sandler fans, it hits a rough patch. Earlier, it hit a rough patch because as Sandler fans, it was really hard to talk about like why you were really in love with Little Nicky or Mr. Deeds or that kind of shit and not have to face some type of like side eye at family parties, right? And this is the moment where it becomes really kind of hard to kind of even defend Pixels. And I think that's key, because there is no rise without a fall. And like, I'm very excited to talk about what our final movie is in this 6-part like introduction that we're doing for this. But I think it's a key that in order for us to explain thoroughly next episode why we were so excited about what that movie was, you have to look at this part of his career and recognize that there's something missing here.
Yeah. This type of film is the reason why people see Ben Stiller in Hubie Halloween and say, is there an interconnected Adam Sandler cinematic universe? And
Yeah, man. But let's talk about some good stuff. First of all, you've already kind of dropped some hints about this, and I want to point this out. The reasons why this actually makes sense as a Sandler cinematic universe for me, I've always talked about one of the big rules being the idea of the love of friend and family, and the number of fucking Sandlers in this movie is insane. First of all, his wife is in it as the secretary to the president. Both of his daughters are in it. They show up both as the lemonade girl and one of the Girl Scouts in the Girl Scout scene. But also, his nephew, who is apparently a very well-renowned stand-up comic, shows up as Zac Efron in the fucking board meeting with all of the government officials when he was like picking on this dude in that
it's
scene.
It's an old game my dad would play. That's
And like that moment when he's like giving that dude shit, I was just like, man, that dude must be having the day of his life getting picked on by Adam Sandler. And then the credits rolled and it mentioned it was Jared Sandler, and I was like, oh, no fucking way. And sure enough, it's his nephew.
Yeah.
So that shit is just all over this movie. So like, hell yes.
And just talking about love of friends and family, one of the strongest moments in this film is when Brenner says to Ludlow, Ludlow thanks him for being his friend, and he says, of course, buddy, I love you. And, like, I love that. I love that showcase of love between two heterosexual men who are completely comfortable with that.
Well, and it's completely earned. That's the other key part. It's not something that comes out of nowhere. It's not a moment that doesn't make sense. It's also not a revelation for him to realize how much he cares about this dude. We've known since the first moment he met Ludlow how much he cares about him. Like, when we see them as kids and he goes, well, you can hang out with us, the first thing they do is give him, like, an arm around the shoulder hug.
Yeah. But, like, it's so great that you – it's the moment – I'm fucking crying because –
It's good relationships throughout this movie. Even the relationship that he has with Chewie, the relationship that he has with Ludlow, even the relationship that they all have with Eddie is one of mutual like respect and understanding as humans. As much as like there's moments where they will riff on each other or call each other nicknames and stuff, there's never a moment of hatred amongst any of them, even amongst Brenner and Eddie, where like Brenner is like, look, I don't love that we're doing this. He's never mean to Eddie, and vice versa. Eddie is like, he calls him second place a bunch of times in Silver Medal, but upon realizing what Eddie had been doing the whole time, you realize that Eddie the entire time knows that he cannot push Brenner that far because he doesn't earn it. He doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. There's just a lot of love in this movie. And maybe that's part of what carries it forward for me, and that is definitely a hallmark of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Thank you, CJ. I had almost wavered on this film.
No, but like the friends and family are clearly a part of this film. Not as on display as we've seen in other movies. There's no specific elderly character that he's latched onto that we can point to and things like that. But those are just shortcuts and cheat codes, right? For like figuring out that element of it. It's there. You just got to dig a little deeper in this one. There's all sorts of silly shit that I have notes about. Written on like three lines, I have to point out, as somebody that was really paying attention to this movie for the first time, when you first see that dude get pixelated, this movie's fucking horrifying.
Dude, the one that you see, Afion Crockett's character, right? Who was taken as the trophy of the attacking Guam. And when he's pixelated, like, that is a moment, like, they were trying to give stakes, right? Show, don't tell in that moment. But then the one that, like, legitimately got me is the dude who gets eaten by Centipede. Because that guy is dead.
Yeah.
That guy is dead. And it's the one truly graphic death that you get in this film. Because even like when the fire truck is being eaten by Pac-Man, all the firemen are jumping out of it. Like, everybody avoids.
I will point out that dude's hand comes back at the end of this movie. Do you think that dude comes back after getting eaten by centipedes?
I hope so. But we don't know.
It's not confirmed. Like, it's not confirmed at all.
Does the pinky car come back after getting eaten by centipedes? I mean, eaten by Pac-Man? Like, is there a level of degradation of a person to pixelation? Voxelation, really. Let's just, I wanted to get that out of the way early. They're voxels because they exist in a 3D space. So they're volume pixels. But pixels is, you know, more marketable. I get that. But like, that guy's been separated for a long time. And also, he is not always composed of light the way that other things are. Plus, there's nothing left to rebuild off of. He's just gone.
But this movie is fucking horrifying. Like, there are scary ass moments in this movie. And then even the attack on the Taj Mahal is horrifying to watch. It's like, oh, it's cute because it's Pong, but no, like, that's upsetting. There's the moment, and I think the moment where I was already still in like scary horror face, but then like they tried to be cutesy, is when fucking Duck Hunt shows up in that woman's house, and they were trying to be cutesy with Duck Hunt showing up, and then it kisses the old woman, and I still had a look of shock on my face because that dude had gotten eaten by centipedes, and I was just like, oh, fuck that, get that thing, kill that thing, kill it now.
See, my shock of horror, my face of shock and horror was, how the fuck did the Voluvians know about Duck Hunt when all they got was a video sent in 1982 and Duck Hunt wasn't invented or released until 1985?
See, it's really hard to not. This movie invites the shitty nerd in you to come out. It really does.
Like, it's one of those situations where I'm like, oh, that's cute, right? Like, Duck Hunt's a fun thing to like signal and like, oh my goodness, but no. Same with like, I don't think a Smurfs game was released in 1982. The Smurf of it all is very weird. Like, that is very much, oh, by the way, Chris Columbus did some Smurf movies for Sony. You should watch those.
And that maybe has to be the joke, right? Because they're not, okay, let's talk about pixelation. You brought up the idea of voxes, and we're talking about Smurfs. That leads to the eventual conversation about Lady Lisa, right? That's her name, Lisa.
Lisa from Dojo Quest.
Why does she get to be a full-on human?
Why is she high definition? That's what I wrote.
And right. Well, so like, and between that, the Smurfs are also way more high definition than they ever would have been in any old Smurfs game from Atari. Like, they were, sorry, go ahead, you were saying a thing.
Well, the reason why this is the discussion, as soon as we saw pixels for the very first time, the discussion driving home was, why was Lady Lisa a real human? And upon watching it many, many times, there is a beautifully rendered drawing of her in the opening of Dojo Quest. That's what Ludlow is talking to when they meet him. So there was already a higher res version of that character. So it almost kind of makes sense that they can use the light to shape and reflect that higher res image of her that is known to exist.
All right. Okay. Okay. And I'm willing to walk away from this one.
And, reason with the Smurfs, right? The same argument, and that same argument matches with the Smurfs in the fact that that game, like one of the early Smurf games, most of the Smurf games were never released in America because Peyo and everything that he does, it is Europeans eat that stuff up. They love the Smurfs far more than Americans love the Smurfs. So there are a bunch of games and stuff that exist in Europe that never came to America. But like one of the first ones, because the Smurfs were still big, it did have a beautifully animated moment in it that could also match that. Like those are my two bits of evidence to almost support why they are able to look so good.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Smurfs, there was, like, a Smurfs, like, hide-and-seek game or some bullshit like that, like, early on. So, like, I wasn't surprised the Smurfs were included. Now that you mentioned that Chris Columbus did the Smurfs movies, I'm also like, all right, then that's clearly where the pull is as well, right? But, like, the joke of the Smurf felt so, it was another one of those moments where I was like, if you're in the know, this is an okay joke to make, but not like a gut buster. And if you're not in the know, you just are scratching your head. So again, it's a lot of these like wide swings and they just never land. It was just another moment of that.
Right. And it's on the, and it comes, it stops the flow of what is supposed to be the big like rumble at the end of the movie.
I mean, it allows Michelle Moynihan to have the wonderful line of "Don't tell anybody I killed a Smurf," and like I appreciate that, but like if that was the payoff, it wasn't enough.
Dude, and the weirdest thing about that line was given to Chewie in both trailers. Trailer one, he gets "Nobody tell anybody I killed a Smurf." Trailer two, he gets "Nobody tell anyone I pixelated the Smurf," and then in the actual film, it goes to Michelle Moynihan. And it almost feels like, oh, Michelle Moynihan really hasn't said anything for the last half hour of this movie.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
So more on the side of the stuff that I really,
sorry,
like,
I didn't mean to.
No. This movie invites it. Like this is going to be the dark chapter. This is our Infinity War before our Endgame. Like I have to say that like I really appreciate the idea that they don't shy away from the fact that this is a world threat. Too often do these kinds of movies just kind of seem to weirdly reflect on like, oh no, they're coming to destroy the world, and they only attack Seattle, they only attack Chicago, they only attack New York. But the idea that this is a world threat is pretty clear in this film. Just appreciated just that element of it. Got to give that shout out.
Do you think that might be why it feels so empty? Because look at the other Adam Sandler films that we've seen. They are contained.
If in those world shots they filled those worlds up, it would feel better. What the fuck was showing India and showing two people? The most populous country in the world, and you have the nerve to just show two human beings in that scene.
I think that's the message that they're trying to send. I don't know. That's a... Yeah. Oof. Sijin,
but like fire. So yes, I feel that those scenes lead to that empty feeling of the world, but it's not because of the settings. I don't feel like placing a movie in India makes it feel empty. Quite the opposite, actually.
Right, but that's the thing. You've drawn the map bigger, but unless you put NPCs in there, it still feels empty, Ubisoft.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, there's your moment to throw, like, an actor we all love, like Rodney Dangerfield shows up for a moment, or Harvey Keitel playing a tourist in England or something. You know what I mean? Like, make me feel like there's more going on in this world rather than what's happening to Brenner. But, like, they show you the world and then don't do that. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. My next note is about Crystal Head Vodka and about how we've come to Dan Aykroyd's payment for this movie. Ah, man. Just, like, right there, right into the camera.
It's one of those moments where like, oh, she's not drinking because she prefers Crystal Skull Vodka. the smooth vodka made by a celebrity. No, not Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, you know, just a quick obvious point in that movie. Yeah. No, I really like the centipede scene and the wrap up in the bar and stuff like that. I think that if this movie, I feel like that is this movie at its best. Like, that is what that movie wants to be. It is what it is trying to be every moment of it. And that's when it nails it, is both of those scenes.
Yeah, that is the wonderful thing, because Pac-Man, as good a scene as Pac-Man is, I mean, there is something so, what I wrote in a direct reference to The Phantom Menace is, now that's what I call speed running. When Bremmer is counting down to know how much time before Pac-Man is an idiot if he tries to eat him, like, that is so good. That is experimentation with games.
The Pac-Man scene is this movie. Like, as far as I'm concerned, that is the part that, again, like, I remember that about this movie. And if you take nothing else away from Pixels, it is the Pac-Man scene, chasing them in the mini coops and then him counting down, all of that.
But then the follow-up to that feels so unorganic compared to them all just sharing a beer at a pub in London. Yeah. It feels so inorganic that, like, there's going to be a party in a day. And we need to set up for Brenner asking, you know, Violet to go with him as his sort of date. Yeah. And, like, it's like, no, like, they should just be at a bar again. Like, that's who these guys are. And it even feels that way when he's like, all right, one more life and then it's happy hour. Like, no, we're going to make you guys wait and we're going to have a gala. And
can I rock your world?
Yeah, rock my world.
This is when it steps away from the Ghostbusters of it all. Yeah. Like, them going out, killing a bunch of aliens, and then going for a beer is very Ghostbusters. The second that you introduce the idea of, like, the presidential gala is when it starts to step away from that kind of story. Yeah. These are not just exterminators at that point. These guys are now government officials. These are the Men in Black now.
Yeah, it is. It's awful. And again, I don't want to shine on bad moments, and I actually think I can make this one good. Josh Gad, right? He commits in this movie.
You
can't say that he doesn't commit in this movie. Him singing Everybody Wants to Rule the World and then humping the stage is like a moment that I have never been okay with. It did make Everybody Wants to Rule the World a regular song in my rotation of, like, if I'm playing old video games and want a kick-ass soundtrack, that's probably on my list. But I don't like how he sings it. It sticks with me as, like, as memorable as the Pac-Man scene is for everybody else. Josh Gad singing Everybody Wants to Rule the World is that for me. And it's sad. And then it's also sad when you read that wasn't in the script. That was Josh Gad improvising.
Yeah, I mean, God knows, maybe it's one of those you had to be there moments, which inevitably happens in all of these kind
all
of
the
movies,
time,
where
yeah.
they just loved on set, so they were like, that has to be the movie, and then it's in the movie, and you're just like, I don't get what's happening. It's like a friend showing you a YouTube video they swear is funny.
Granddad.
Yeah. yeah, man, like, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that happens, but I think that, like, this movie just has so many great shining moments of that friendship and that idea of them just being normal dudes. And so I didn't see the Ghostbusters of it all when we first started talking about this. But I think when I'm thinking about those moments specifically of like them in the field, like taking out the centipedes and them going for the beer after and them getting to be like friends with arms around each other, like that is Ghostbusters, right? It's like the guys just doing the dirty work and loving each other is very Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I say that is the major set piece is set in New York, and it's a bunch of guys fighting a giant kaiju-esque monster.
Of a thing that they loved when they were children.
Yeah, like it feels that way, and you need to consider Sony is Ghostbusters, right?
Yeah.
So that's the well that they're trying to revisit constantly. And then a year later, they release Ghostbusters Answer the Call. So, like, it's not completely off base to think about it in those terms. It's one of those things where it's always kind of in the back of my mind, especially when you look at the light gun, the light cannon technology. I mean, the right. best part about those light cannons is the fact that the activation button is an arcade button. That yeah. is what will forever sell me. Like, the scenic work and the prop design in this film, they did a good job.
I mean, the CGI, and I've always loved Sony CGI. Go back and listen to when Ghostbusters Answer the Call for, like, I've gushed about the CGI even in that movie. I've loved, like, Sony's animation, CGI animation department for their live-action movies forever. And I love the way that the pixeled creatures in this movie look and the way that they interact with the world. I mean, Qbert, for all of the silly-ass jokes around him, is actually I never personally found him cringy until it got to the Josh Gad stuff at the end of this movie. But, like the jokes about him eating the cheese balls and shit like that, like, I liked all of that stuff. And him walking around the world with them and being part of their club, like, worked for me. Like, it's a really fun movie when it's on fire. It's just that there's definitely moments of this movie where it's kind of just hot embers. It's not quite a flame.
Qbert's fucking Slimer. I hate yeah. myself. I didn't. No, I mean, like, never even considered it till like right there. And Qbert in his little tuxedo, right? Oh, to double thumbs up. To double thumbs up.
Yeah, man.
All right. So, I mean, this is the first time that we're getting to the to get into a film and kind of having these feelings, right? The fact that we're jumping into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, we're charting a course and we're creating laws. And I need to know, Seijin, in your opinion, is this really in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, or did we go past about a border and we're going to have to scoop back in afterwards?
I think for me, the deciding line on that is if someone in a new Adam Sandler movie that clearly referenced Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, or Little Nicky, if they then also reference Pixels, would I be confused or offended? No. I think this fits. I think this fits into the universe. I think there's enough stuff going on here that definitely makes it feel like if Brenner wanted to team up with Billy, with Happy at some point to take on the world for some reason, like, I could definitely see them running into each other. So, like, I think it fits. I will say, I don't know if we had experienced Little Nicky, I'd feel the same way. Something about the way that Little Nicky blew the doors off of, like, absurdism and heaven and hell kind of opened the doors for things like, yeah, aliens that are shaped like video game characters are okay now too. Like, but that's a caveat that doesn't need to be placed. Yes, I think that this fits in.
I mean, it's kind of a caveat that needs to be placed, because our big addition to the laws of the ASCU is that Little Nicky is the linchpin. And if Little yeah. Nicky is the linchpin, and it's what allows you to come to terms with something like Pixels existing in the same space as the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, there's some that's some serious weight that Little yeah. Nicky is holding up.
But for sure, I think this movie fits, and I think that I think there's definitely a way that in future episode, in future movies, if they were just like, yeah, like that time that Pac-Man attacked New York, I'd be like, yeah, right? Reference. And I wouldn't be weirded out.
Yeah, I don't disagree. In fact, I mean, going all the way back to Billy Madison and the discussion about, I think Mortal Kombat is the best video game of all time, I disagree. Mortal Kombat is a good game, but Donkey Kong sucks. You suck. Adam Sandler likes video games. He established it in the very first one, so it's not super surprising. Also, I gotta go see about that Asteroids Machine and Billy Madison. There were, not Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore. Stop me, Seijin. He's staring at me. Like, video games and the tie-in video game from Little Nicky, it's not something that was never discussed in the films beforehand.
For sure.
Like, if this were the first time that video games were the focus, this is definitely just a paycheck chasing the trends and trying to seem relevant.
Yeah, I think that if Adam Sandler had really been at the helm of this movie, you would have had a lot more video game jokes about how, like, in Mortal Kombat, if you did, like, up, up, left, left, you would have seen fucking Katana naked. Like, that would have been more of the comedy. So, like, maybe it's a good thing that misses that, like, in this, like, we have this kind of thing that, like, that's the other thing. As much as we joked, like, shot the shit about, like, something quote-unquote blue in this movie, This is also probably the least offensive film that we have watched in this entire series. So, like, if I was going to show something to my parents and be like, I'm talking about Adam Sandler movies, here's one of them, this would probably be the one I'd point to right now.
Yeah, it weirdly does it. In fact, it also does a lot. The closest they get to really like toxic masculinity is that transition from them being 13 to being 43, where he's like, "You can marry Olivia Newton-John." And I was thinking Samantha Fox. She's no Sheena Easton into Scarlett Johansson though. Oh man, but Katy Perry, we can't
Well,
do this. We're too old. Like, it's
right, they
calling
call it
out
out.
how
Yeah, they call it
toxic that
out.
is, and it's
Yeah.
just like, wow, that's awesome. That was like, it's like this moment that I've all but forgotten, and then it's like, but that's important to like these films being accessible and growing up with the audience.
Well, and part of it, not only do they call it out, but part of it is also that, like, dudes being attracted to women, like, there are definitely ways in which men can talk about it that can be really upsetting and gross. But, like, two dudes talking to each other about women that they find attractive is on the low end of the scale of offensive sexual conversation that they could be having.
No, definitely. But I
Yeah.
think it's just that nice that hip check is nice.
Yeah,
That
for sure.
like, you know, we're in our 40s now. Should we really be judging
Right.
attractive women in Hollywood? Like, you're married and I don't know what I am.
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, it doesn't even register for me, but, like, looking back on the movie, I guess the thing that I would point to is, like, again, the worst offender of this, the Chuck Lorre-esque, like, nature in which it treats people that like video games is also kind of weird. But that is not something I would consider blue. That's just stupid.
Yeah. That's just pop culture chasing trends. I
Yeah.
mean, this is made in a world where Twitch has existed for 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's. And game. Like, people are making money playing video games.
Yeah.
So
I
the
do want to
whole.
give
Yeah.
yeah, sorry. No, go ahead. Make your
No.
point.
No, that's it. That's just. That is my point. I've made my point. Like.
Yeah, I think this movie also deserves a really cool shout out for the soundtrack. We didn't really talk too much about it. But it has a pretty fucking rad one up until the credits roll, and then suddenly weirdly it goes into one of those like 90s style let's rap about the movie songs.
Waka Flocka Flame!
Yeah, which I love Waka Flocka Flame. Well, okay, wait a minute. Is that the immediate song that plays? Because it sounds like there's like a Sum 41 song that plays at first.
It is a Waka Flocka Flame song
Yeah.
that plays. It
Yeah,
goes
but it.
from, I think it's Surrender Again
Yeah.
into my favorite thing, right? Like, if you ended up not liking this movie, and I don't know, did you like this movie or not before I say this?
Yeah,
Like,
no,
you've shared this with your parents,
if this
so.
movie was on, no, if I went to your house and you were like, well, the Deckers are watching Pixels today, I'd sit down and watch it with you guys. I wouldn't leave the house.
You wouldn't run away? That's
Yeah.
nice of you. And my big argument was it does that thing that Seijin loves so much, which is music video in a different art style that retells the events of the film.
I
And
will
it,
give it that.
yeah.
Yeah, with the pixelated stuff and things like that. Yeah, for sure. It was just that on the heels of a soundtrack of so much great classic rock that fit with the classic video games, to then turn into that was like just a hard left that I just wasn't ready for. But that being said, like the soundtrack, I would all around just recommend, like if nothing, listen to the goddamn soundtrack for this movie. It's super good.
Oh yeah, like I said, all of these movies, all of these songs in this movie, they're on my Devin Decker gaming like playlist, Gaming with Devin Decker. I don't know why I said it wrong the first time. All right, but does this introduce any new laws or commandments into the ASCU?
I mean, the big one, like you mentioned already, aliens are real. I think we can't ignore that. If we're going to acknowledge because of Little Nicky that heaven and hell is real, this is aliens are real, and then we're going to talk about something else with Hubie Halloween. But the idea is that this stuff is there, I think is key, and I think that's important. But the other thing that I think is a little bit more kind of under the surface, but kind of not that far under the surface, is this is when we start to realize how much Adam Sandler really works nostalgia into his movies. And looking back, we've already noted that. I mean, his love of old movies, of things like Back to School and like Bad News Bears and all that sort of shit, like The Longest Yard, which we then see him remake eventually. Like he loves old cinema. And so like nostalgia is not anything new, but this one really puts it on display. So it being a key part of the formula, this is what it kind of brought to the table for me. As a rule for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, I think nostalgia is key.
I agree. I think that's very important. And definitely, yeah, we've already discussed it, but this is the one that proves that what can make a film that doesn't walk or talk like an Adam Sandler film still feel like an Adam Sandler film is Adam Sandler getting to live in a warm cocoon of nostalgia for things that he used to care about.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so is there anything else? I think that I mean, aliens existing is a huge deal. And also Eddie Plant being a semi-wizard. That would explain a lot of things, like the Martha Serena sandwich. It's totally tubular. He's the
Oh,
fire
man.
blaster because he can shoot magic missiles.
Yeah. Oh, I will say this, completely divorced from the Sandler universe, I want to see fucking Peter Dinklage play the Tiger King in a movie, like in a fucking heartbeat.
Like that bitch Carol Baskin's Tiger King?
Yeah,
I haven't
exactly.
watched that, but I support it. I want
Watch
Peter
that.
Dinklage in
Watch that.
everything.
Oh yeah, fucking Dinklage. He. So when the kid playing him came on, I was like, "Well, this is silly and over the top child acting." And then he came on, and it was almost beat for beat the same thing. I was like, "Fair enough, Dinklage. Fair enough." Yeah, no, I want to watch him in everything and anything. But I, no joke. Watch the Tiger King documentary if you have not seen it yet. Watch it for the first time with fresh eyes, and the entire time, imagine that dude being just portrayed by Peter Dinklage instead in this movie, and it is perfection.
I will have to take your word for it until there's a time where I've run out of things to watch. But then again, we do another podcast, The Say Report, that's about everything. You son of a bitch.
Oh.
All right. So yeah, I don't have anything else. I mean, it's definitely still worth watching. It's nice to know that it was a success, but not the kind of success that warrants a franchise or anything like that. I mean, I'm disappointed. I will reiterate my disappointment at that, but other than that, good for you, Pixels. Be in the movie that you are.
Yeah.
And aging pretty well. Like,
Oh,
this is
yeah.
definitely a flash in the pan. Like, I mean, it comes a little bit too late, right? 'Cause when King of Kong came out and Seth Gordon made that documentary, and then they're like, we're gonna make a movie based on the King of Kong. Like, this is that movie, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And this is too late for a movie related to King of Kong, right? And I wonder if that's why Steve Wiebe's scene was cut, is like, you're not relevant anymore, Mr. Wiebe, to what this film is.
Bullshit, Steve Wiebe, I love you. I know you listen. I love you.
I love you too, Steve
I cry
Wiebe.
every time I watch that documentary, no matter what version, no matter what ending. I always root for you.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's just like, it feels like it came too late to still be relevant in the
Yeah.
world where King of Kong captured a nation's consciousness.
Yeah, no.
Like, it.
I don't disagree. It was too little, too late for me. Yeah.
And then for the film to still be insanely watchable
Right.
6 years after the fact. I'm surprised. I mean, I've watched it every year, but usually to like psych me up for going to a video game convention. And you know, that's none of those are happening anytime soon, but it still put me in that good mood to like get my game on.
No, y'all got kids? You want to watch something other than whatever animated movie they've watched, made you watch a million times? Put Pixels on once. They'll enjoy the hell out of it the one time they watch it. It'll become their Ghostbusters. This is what ha the this is the kind of movie that becomes the Ghostbusters for some group of kids 10 years from now.
Jeez. I hope that's true. I want this to have that
Ghostbusters 2.
Ghostbuster
This
love.
is this is
Ghostbusters
this is
2.
the kind of movie that becomes the Ghostbusters 2 for kids 10 years from now. I'll say that.
I see that. I mean, Pac-Man 99 is out there on the Switch. your kids are playing it. They're like, I like Pac-Man. Let's show them why they shouldn't like Pac-Man. I mean, he's been brainwashed. He's a good boy. But that's not going to stop him from eating his daddy's hand in some real Pinocchio Geppetto shit.
Oh, shit.
All right. So, anything else before we send this one off to the vault?
Josh Gad, he definitely has intercourse with Q-Bert in this movie. And I'm glad we didn't spend a lot of time talking about it, but, like, we would be remiss if we did not also just, like, warn people about that.
It really bothers me that he has intercourse with Lady Lisa, and then they have 5 Q-Bert babies.
Yeah, why does Q-Bert need to change into him? And why does it need to be a trophy? Why does the word trophy need to be used? It is what it is. But, yeah, you're going to leave this movie with this exact feeling of just like, I enjoyed my time with it, but man, I just don't know if I could, I don't know.
One specific thing.
Exactly. I need to ignore a couple of things in this movie, and then I had a great time with it, is going to be the way that you walk away. So.
Oh, man. Like, it has a sour taste in my mouth. You know what? I do have to applaud them, though. I do have to applaud them. Those Q-Bert babies at the end could have, and probably should have, had some Josh Gad-ism to show that he is their father, and they avoided that.
No, because we all know that Q-Bert populates asexually.
Oh, man. So is he still a virgin? Like, he weirdly decries as Pac-Man's about to kill him?
Well.
Oh, man. Wait, if Q-Bert does it asexually, the cloaca thing kind of becomes moot, right?
Yeah, thankfully. Thank God. Yes, exactly. Clears up that horrific thought in my mind. Although we do watch him pee at some point in this movie.
Dude, I don't know. We have to talk about the next movie, so you're prepared for it, so that if you're watching along with us and you've just finished a Pixels journey with us, you know that next time on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we are going to be talking about the film that kind of kicked off this conversation. That's right, Uncut Gems. No, I'm kidding. It is Hubie Halloween.
Yeah, and actually, I want to encourage you that if this is some journey that you've just joined us on, like, do go back and listen to the old ones. This is not like the Say Report, where we date the shit out of it by talking about, like, in the news stuff. Like, this is timeless stuff, and I think that you will be better served listening to the, essentially, like, season one wrap-up of this show of what is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe if you start with number one. Because, like, there's gonna have to be some conversation about it being the thing that specifically for Devin and I want to make that clear, specifically for Devin and I, is the thing that prompted this idea of talking about a connected universe. Not that we were, like, ignorant to the fact that it had been somewhat connected before, but Hubie does some stuff, so let's talk about it.
Yeah, Hubie definitely does some stuff, so if you haven't seen the other movies up to this point, Hubie is the one worth watching, too, to truly understand why we embarked upon this trip. But please go back, because much like a code of honor, our laws, tenets, and commandments of what creates the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is a living thing. And if you follow us on the journey, you can see how in the beginning, the only connection that Pixels had to the Adam Sandler cinematic universe was that the female lead had a double V name. And then we went out and found a way to actually fit it in. And
well, and I would say not even that we, like, forced it into this mold, but that we realized that the mold set forth allowed for it.
Yes. And that's what it's about. It's about seeing how that mold happened, and things that fit now might not fit in 3-4 months when we're looking at other films.
Yes.
And that's the most important thing about this star chart of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, is that I'm ready and willing to admit a mistake. And if you don't go back and listen just to this season before seeing how it wraps up, you might not see where that mistake happened. And wouldn't that stink?
Yeah, right? Call us out, is what we're saying.
Yeah,
but
we want it to be
I'm
a
excited.
Discussion. And that's...
I'm excited for next week. Or next month. Man,
yeah.
Keep thinking.
Next month. I know, right? I love that it's monthly, though, because I really get to sink my teeth into these. It's a good time.
Yes.
All right. So, if you liked what you heard here at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we are on Twitter at the ASCU. You can also always get us by sending a direct email to AdamSandlerCinematicUniverse@gmail.com. We have another podcast that releases weekly called The Say Report. So if you like us focusing in on Adam Sandler and his films, you might like us talking about everything, literally everything. Everything is on the table for The Say Report. So, you know, you might get an episode where we talk about School Ties starring Brendan Fraser, or you might get an episode where we talk about the socioeconomic impact of the fact that people don't want to go back to work anymore. It's kind of a grab bag.
Well, and we'd be remiss if we did not mention that as we are in the month of remembrance for Brendan Fraser, Brendan Fraser History Month, we are going to be also talking about an Adam Sandler movie this month, Dev, and I think it'd be key if we did for us to mention that.
That is very true.
This special episode this month, as already announced on the Say Report, because it stars Brendan Fraser and Adam Sandler, we are going to be talking about Airheads. So tune into that special episode to just get kind of a bonus Sandler-esque episode.
Yeah. And that very special episode of The Say Report, that always drops the last Thursday of the month. So much like you get your Adam Sandler fix the second Friday of the month, if you just want to get a little bit extra Adam Sandler from our Brendan Fraser episode, that's going to be the last Thursday of May, which I want to say is the 27th, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah, that makes sense because I think I get the 28th off work.
There
oh,
you
sorry.
Go. Well, the 25th is a Tuesday. So, yeah, it's the 27th. So May 27th, our Airheads episode will drop. And if in the meantime you would like to send Siegen pictures of Qbert's cloaca, he is available on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you have other other video game historical inaccuracies that you found while watching Pixels, send them to Devin at Devin D. Decker.
All right. So before this gets any more catastrophic, I just want to remind you all that we have no idea what we're doing. Have a nice night. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.